with A.
Okay. Velkommen til programmet om USA efter valget. I studiet er Alexander Swaff og Abraham Copenhagen ved teknikken, og mig, Joanna Søjer, som jeres vært. Og vi har 4 gæster online fra USA, og de vil fortælle os, hvordan de hver især ser den politiske situation i USA. Vi vil gerne høre deres vurdering af Trump regeringstid og hans eftermæle, reaktioner på besættelse af kongressen den 6. maj, og hvordan de ser på fremtiden, blandt andet på de fremtidige relationer mellem USA og Israel, i lyset af den hidtil manglende kontakt mellem landene efter valget. Programmet vil foregå på engelsk. Vores gæster er Alan Portman, som er administrerende direktør i konsulentfirma Myriad Strategic Partners. Hans interesse eller fokusområde er strategikommunikation, udvikling og andre organisationsaktiviteter. Han har været politisk reporter for Boston Globe og blandt andet dækket kongressen, Det Hvide Hus og indtil flere præsidentvalg. Vi har også Peter Pollack, som er medlem af en college-fakultet. Han er Ph.D. i historie og undervisning og uddannelse, og for tiden skriver romaner og erindringer. Og så har vi Steve Levy, som er systemingeniør og ejer af en mekanisk teknisk virksomhed. Og Alan Portman, som er elektronikingeniør og som arbejder med design og management. Og der er også en stille gæst i baggrunden, som ikke deltager, men som er med på en lytter på den amerikanske side, Robert Hurwitz. Og nu går vi i gang med den engelske version, så jeg håber, at alle kan forstå, hvad der bliver sagt. Okay. Welcome to our guests on Radio Shalom. I have presented you shortly to our listeners. And I would like you to present yourself in your own words, maybe with an angle on where you stand politically, if you're Democrat or Republican, to make it more clear for us to understand your views in further discussions. So how about you start, Adam?
Sure. Excuse me. I'm Adam Portman. I don't speak Danish, so I'll just briefly say that I think I'm sitting here because I was a journalist for 25 years, most of them with the Boston Globe. I covered several. I was the political editor for the Globe. I was the foreign editor, excuse me, for the Globe. I also was a political correspondent for many years. I covered presidential elections, congressional elections, and have some background in the subject we're going to be discussing. Today, I'm a communications consultant. My politics are definitely left of center. I have voted for Republicans and Democrats, mainly Democrats, in my lifetime. My training for a very long time was to try, to the best of my abilities, to put my personal biases aside. That's not possible because we're all human, but I'm pretty well trained in trying to present information in a way that hopefully is less partisan and based on what the evidence shows. And I should also say that I went on from journalism to head a national not-for-profit organization in the world of child welfare. I'm a subject matter expert in that realm. And what we did was conducted research, and I did that for a dozen years. So I also believe deeply that the evidence should steer you and not just your emotions, though I have them, I won't deny it. And I certainly have strong views when anyone locks kids in cages. I don't need, you know, a whole lot of research to feel strongly about that. But I will try to the best of my ability during the course of this, to to walk that line and try to stick to the evidence rather than just to my own emotional or political leanings.
Thank you very much. Peter Pollack, please.
Yes. Hello, and it's a pleasure to be here with all
Welcome.
Of you. Share our ideas. You'll find some different viewpoints, and hopefully they'll be informative. I come from upstate New York. My parents were refugees from Nazi Europe, and I went to undergraduate college in Ohio, Oberlin College. Then went into VISTA, a volunteer program, spent a year in Atlanta, marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, became very much involved in the civil rights movement, the equal rights movement, went back to college, got a PhD, taught for a while, left that and started my own company, a computer news service company in 1985. It still exists, although it's evolved tremendously. It's no longer, because of the technology and other factors, what it was. It's now a multiple service company. So politically, I started on the left. I was a socialist, but I became very much discouraged with the left, especially after the breakup of SDS, which was a Students for Democratic Society organization that I belonged to, and have slowly moved to the center and then to the right. I wrote a memoir called From Left to Right, which chronicles that transition. And I voted for Donald Trump, I'm proud to say, in two elections. He's not my favorite person of all time, but I think he was had the right message. So we could talk more about that as we go along.
Thank you very much. So welcome to Robert Hurwitz, please.
Thank you, Joanna. I'm just here as a silent partner. Alan Perkman asked me to in charge of talent acquisition, and I approached Peter Pollack, and he graciously accepted the role. He's in the congregation that I'm in, and Steve Levy is an all longtime friend. So you won't hear any more from me, but my thanks go to Alan for kind of orchestrating this, and Peter and Steve Levy for accepting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Steve Levy, welcome to the club.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The name's Levy because my great-grandparents were Levy. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, they decided to change it into something that I always have to correct people how to say my name, which has been a burden my whole life. And so that's a little background. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and lived in Chicago as a little boy, back to New York City and Long Island. I went to school on a scholarship to a school in New York City that's free called Cooper Union. It's an art school and engineering and architecture school. When I finished there, I went to NYU and got graduate degrees in engineering. And from there, I joined IBM and was a systems engineer for IBM with some of the largest corporations in America in Manhattan, where their headquarters were. My father opened up, he was a mechanical engineer, and he opened up a mechanical contracting firm in Washington, D.C. Now, for those not familiar, it's basically a plumbing and HVAC air conditioning type company, except we did heavy construction for sewage plants and subways, did a lot of work out at Dulles Airport and so on. I opened up my own firm named after my son, Joshua, and it's called Joshua Construction. And he got his name when I saw the Ten Commandments and I saw Joshua leaving Egypt, and he stood up on a stone and said, "Follow me," and he mentioned all the tribes' names, and I loved the name before anyone chose it. Now half the people in America seem to be Joshuas. And now I'm retired, and I do a lot of different things. Politically, I've always been left. I'm still left. My heart is to help people, and money is less of an object. And I don't feel the Republican approach giving to the rich is the way to help the poor. And so I want direct payments and things for them because they're, well, that's where I come from. At one time in New York City, I voted liberal. But when I got onto preliminary, there were no liberal organizations, so I changed to Democrat. And that's where I stand. My wife is a very ardent Democrat. We've got pictures with her with Obama. And I met Mr. Biden out in a baseball stadium once. He's a wonderful man. And all he did for an hour was to talk to people.
Thank you very much. We need to go on. Alan, your turn, please.
Yes, I'm Alan Pertman. I wanted to throw in a couple personal remarks right up front. This occasion is very special for me. My parents are Holocaust survivors, so all my life I was aware of the role that the Danish community, that Denmark as a country, had played during the Holocaust by rescuing the Danish community, by moving the entire community to the neutral country of Sweden. So in my heart of hearts, the very name Denmark is written in gold. That's how I feel about the country.
Thank
and
you.
I root for their soccer team every World Cup tournament.
Thank you very much.
Sure, sure. So we are an immigrant family to United States. We came here about 60 some years ago from Poland by way of shortstop over in Israel. I left Poland at the age of 16 and a half. I had been a product of their political indoctrination. The communist regime in Poland focused on my demographic age group. They could do no work with my parents' generation. They were a lost cause. They've seen too much, experienced too much. But when I came to the United States, I had to reinvent myself politically, so to speak, because I was just totally, totally brainwashed. I embraced it. I believed it. And here I was. Reality was staring me in the face. My first political connection kind of gelled when I listened to John F. Kennedy during his campaign, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I felt this is where I belong. This is how I feel. This is where I belong. That evolved, and politically at this point, I feel I'm in the center. I'm very, very frustrated about the fragmentation and the intensity of the fragmentation that's occurring in many countries, but certainly in the United States. But in all my considerations, my reference points and my reflections have to do with my experiences in Poland growing up.
Thank you very much.
I've experienced the end game, and I absolutely don't like it. So
we understand. We are sure. All three of us are from the same background. So I would like to bring the first subject for you to discuss, and it is, how does, if at all, United States heal after the split under election? And I would like to ask you for short answers. We have a lot of subjects, and I would like to hear your different opinions. Alan, you mentioned it, so I would like to ask Adam to start with the subject.
How do we heal? I think with great difficulty, and not yet. I think the wounds are so deep. I think the blood is still flowing. The incitement, if you will, is still the big lie, is what they're calling it in I think most of the media, not all of it, in the US. I think as long as Donald Trump is the head of the Republican Party, and I think he unequivocally is, and is still, and as long as he denies the reality of what occurred, it's going to keep those wounds fresh. And so I think there has to be some diminution of that rancor of the lie, if you will, some acceptance of reality just as we see it in front of us, and then we can move forward. But I think that that's going to take time. I think this is the pain, the division is still occurring. We're not fixing something that happened. It's still happening.
Thank you. Peter, you are the only right representative here. Yes. I understand, the only sole Republican.
That's right.
Right. So I would like to hear your side of the story. How do you see the possibilities for reconciliation and for healing?
You know, healing and reconciliation are not my priorities, and I don't think they should be the political priorities at all. The best outcome for society is when opposing viewpoints are expressed, and the public, the people, decide through the electoral process. That's what we've had, although the Democrats seem to want to change the rules after the game was already in motion. But be that as it may, we overemphasize, I think, the cost of fragmentation. It's okay for me to have a different point of view from you. I'm not going to change my view unless the facts and the circumstances convince me. It's not just asking me to see it your way. That's not good enough.
No, but if you look it in the perspective of the events of the 6th of January, then it's more than that, just a difference of opinion. It has costed 5 lives, and the Palace of Democracy in Washington has been sieged. So it's not just a question of difference of opinions, because of course we have to have a difference of opinions. Could you?
Yeah, let me comment on that, because here you're focusing on January 6th. Why not focus on the Trump administration and the role that the Democrats played, tried to undermine it, to declare that the 2016 election was illegitimate. Right. They tried to prove it. They never could prove it. They attacked Trump in many ways.
But this is difference of opinions. Attacking verbally is difference of opinions.
It's a rewriting of history is what it is. But
attacking, okay. Attacking with weapons, with violence, breaking in is different. This is what you were advocating, was difference of opinion should be allowed. How do you see the 6th of January as expression?
A terrible event. It was sad to see it. I think the people who were involved in trying to instigate it should be prosecuted if they can be convicted in a due process.
Do you think Donald Trump was instigative in his speech?
No, he supported the events to the extent that they were expressing their support for him, but not the violence. I don't think he advocated violence.
Okay. Any comments on that, Robert? Maybe. No.
No, oh, thank you. I'm silent.
Oops, sorry. Steve.
I have to agree with Adam. I've been watching this, and I was appalled back in when there was an election and the Democratic candidate in the 80s was accused because the policy was to get people out of jail who served their time. And they let one man out and he committed a crime, and they attached to the governor, Dukakis, the fact that this man committed the crime, even though as governor, he wasn't specifically involved. That was the first time they started to do something that was false and attributed that man's actions to the governor and presidential candidate. In the 90s, Newt Gingrich said, no compromises. He was the Republican leader. And it got worse. So they started a philosophy of no compromises, which is not the Democratic way. We try to, I'm not saying compromise is always great. Oftentimes you come up with bad solutions, but you try to get along with people. But the rhetoric was not to get along with people.
Thank you.
And it's just gotten worse and worse. I have to agree with Adam. When you don't listen to the truth and say that the news, all the news is fake, and you no longer listen to it, and there's deafness, I don't believe there's any opportunity to change. And as far as what Peter said, people are not talking to each other. My very, very good friend has had a friend for 50, 60 years. He no longer feels he wants to talk to his friend and his wife. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. I don't talk to my relatives in the same way I used to. I have to avoid subjects because they go off into places. It's just horrible.
And whose fault is it?
It is affecting us. It's not just, my life is being affected, not personally, not just politically.
Thank you. Alan, your comment?
Yeah, as to the event of January 6th, I'd like to kind of bound it by some sense of proportion. How representative is it really of the Republican Party, the Republican sentiment? It was abhorring and terrible. And I personally don't miss Trump not being in the White House, but I'm just not embracing the new regime. And, mm-hmm. and so yeah, in that sense, I'm in the middle.
That's my general comment. I don't know how that could be described as middle of anything. I mean, you're entitled to your views, but it ain't middle.
What's middle?
Okay.
But middle is trying to see what's reasonable on each side. What policies can I support? What do I think the actions of one side, what are the consequences of the actions of one side? Are they reasonable for society? I don't have to agree with them. I have to think they're reasonable, they're thought out, they're compassionate, whatever that may mean. Mm-hmm. It's a subjective judgment always, but after somebody's in office for a month, you got to give, and I said this back when Trump became president, I just want to be on record, I'm not a fan, but I absolutely said, you got to give them time, you got to see what the policies are, you got to see how they play out, you got to see what their impact are. That's fair. And I say the same thing for Biden. And now I wound up again, not caring much for Trump's policies or his demeanor. And I think Biden's demeanor is exactly what this country needs, to your point, Joanna, about healing. We need some calm. This country, nothing good happens when people are irate. People don't think clearly. People don't act as cogently. Reasonable people have some demeanor, some tone that is civil. There's a reason why we talk about civil discourse.
Thank you.
We did not have that for four mm-hmm. years, and it was undermining of people. Even people who sometimes agreed on things shouted at each other. The mm-hmm. tone was horrible, and it was undermining to our country.
Thank you. Peter, you want to attach any comments on?
Sure. You know, again, I think that it's the media has been one-sided in its presentation of, you know, what's terrible about our society and the divisions. The divisions are within parties as well. There's great divisions within the Democrats and divisions within the Republicans. As Alan pointed out, the January 6th was a small group or small couples groups. There were 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. They didn't all come out and riot. They're not all angry and resentful. They're unhappy with the results and some of the policies that have been implemented since then.
What do
you get into those? But I think we're overemphasizing that this is a one-sided problem, that it's the Republicans who are at fault.
I would just a short comment, because what really bamboozles us in Europe is that total denial of facts, the big lie and the small lies, and the ego trip, the narcissism. How you know, I don't understand how you can accept this kind of personality as a leader of the greatest country in the world, with moral authority for that should shine for all of us.
Yeah. So Donald Trump, when he won the election, he expected the Democrats to at least give him a little breathing room and to see what he was advocating, but they attacked right away. And
I'm not talking about the attacks from them. I want to hear your opinion on Trump's attitude and on his personality, on his
because when you're attacked, when you're attacked and you feel very strongly about your opinions, you fight back. You don't just
and you find that it's okay to fight back this way.
Absolutely, there are certain rules and certain boundaries. But you have to fight back.
And if he didn't cross them, in your opinion.
Peter, is it okay to fight back with lies and vituperative name calling and eighth grade insults? That's an okay thing for the role model of the world to do, in your view?
It's more than that.
Steve.
It's more than that. He attacked one side of America and embraced the other. He didn't call us. It was we and them. And as far as Peter, in the first weeks or two, he insulted the leader of Mexico, the leader of New Zealand. He talked negatively towards the leaders of the world. That was in the first week. He removed himself, which was
okay.
No.
We all
reason.
Know. We all kind of saw it. I just want to.
We gave him the chance. He had the. Yeah. He said we didn't give him a chance. He pulled out of everything we did before.
But you know, we understand, like, this side of your society. We do understand, because this is Alexander had a question.
No, I didn't have a question. No. I just had a comment on your being surprised by Trump's behavior or Trump's way of dealing with opposition or with other countries' leaders or anything like it. And I can't really understand why you're so surprised. I mean, you as European is so surprised. Take a person like Boris Johnson, who is being compared to Trump as a European Trump. And if you just go back a couple of years ago, we had Silvio Berlusconi, who was a very controversial figure as well. He was very much like Trump. So don't tell here should be so surprised.
I'm surprised.
We have our own politicians of the type.
Okay, I don't take ownership of Berlusconi. And Boris Johnson has a bigger vocabulary than Trump, so you cannot compare him. He's educated and he's
but Trump is talking
stately.
To people. Boris Johnson doesn't have the support.
We don't have to discuss internally. I think we should try another subject, and it is more directed to the future. How do you see the future, the next 4 years under the leadership of Joe Biden? How do you see the treatment of COVID situation by Joe Biden? And what do you hear in the background? What are the local drums saying about how people feel about the new reality? Please, Steve, maybe. Any comments?
Well, I'm not optimistic in the sense that I don't see us coming together. I just see one side having power and using it. The Democrats usually like to join together with everyone. I don't think they're going to do that now. I think we realize the other side is unwilling to compromise. So we have to go forward. The biggest problem here is economics and the disparity between the top and the bottom. And it's getting worse and worse. And the Republicans don't realize what's causing it or don't want to acknowledge it. Okay. So when you look at the average secretary's pay in, say, the 1950s to compared to the attorney she worked for, and now look at it, or the corporation heads, they're hundreds of times more than they were back in the 50s. And the disparity keeps getting worse. And I often think about the aristocracy in Europe.
Thank you.
They allowed the proletariat or whatever to live, but they took everything else.
Thank you. Alan, an economist?
Yeah, again, I wanted to kind of reflect on the sense of proportion. Donald Trump looms large, but he is not necessarily the Republican Party. The best way I can describe it is in 2016, leading up to the election, which he won 4 years ago, there was a point in time in the American system where both parties go through the process of selection of their prime candidate for presidency. At that time, there was this situation where there were no fewer than 16 or 17 Republicans competing for the nomination for the president. And the Democratic selectee had already floated to the top. It was Hillary Clinton. I felt that any one of the 16, 17 Republicans would have defeated the Democratic candidate, any one of them. It so happens, even at that point, Donald Trump was not being taken seriously by anybody, including the Republicans. I mean, he was the butt of all the jokes and everything. So as a communicator, he's really a failure, even though I have no issues with his politics and with his decisions. So that's where the sense of the middle comes in. He does not represent the party.
I'd like to come back to the future. Does it sound right?
Can I jump in for a moment? I will speak to the future, about which I'm a bit more optimistic. But first, I just want to say that if you agree with all of someone's politics, I think that puts you on the side of that person. But so, and which I think is fair, but I think one should acknowledge it. So the future, I think, is a mixed bag. As I said at the beginning, I think the wounds are very real and they're not healing. It's going to take real time and real effort to accomplish that. With that said, I think that the COVID relief bill that they're about to pass, which is almost $2 billion, is going to do a lot of good. I think it probably is too big and probably will eke some inflation into the system, for which he will be rightly criticized. But what we learned during the last bailout is too big improves your odds, too small it increases the pain or prolongs the pain. So they're erring on that side. I think it's the right thing to do. We'll find out. But I think it will infuse enough money that people, they're already going back to work. They will be going back to work. We have a national plan rolling out for COVID now. We're up to 2 million shots a day. That didn't happen before. A lot of people died because we didn't have a national plan. So I think that people are going to get better. The attitudes will reflect that. The economy will get better. Attitudes will reflect that. The leadership, whether you agree, I think demeanor matters enormously. Ronald Reagan, of whom policy was not a fan, the demeanor was just right. And he carried a lot of people as a result. The polls showed over and over that people who disagreed with him on policy went with him. And it's because leadership requires more than just a policy list.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I'll come back to you, Peter. Robert, any comments on the how do you see the perspective with Joe Biden the next 4 years?
I'll yield to Peter.
Okay. All right. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Peter, I have you on my vision, so I keep asking you all the time. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. you know, I think it's going to be an interesting 4 years. I think it'll determine what happens in 2024. The Democrats are more divided than the media portrays them. They're divided on a lot of issues internally. The left, the far left, with the Ocasio-Cortez and her crowd, and the center, more center-oriented Democrats. You know, if the hard left is able to pass some of their policies, I think it'll be harmful for the Democrats Party's future. I think they have to be put quieted. You mentioned the COVID issue. Let me just comment on that. And that is the $1.9 trillion, as Adam says, is a little too much by probably a trillion. And it contains money for things that have nothing to do with COVID or the economy, but are simply paybacks to Democratic leaders and Democratic legislatures for the mistakes that they've made in governing and expenditures. So it's a boondoggle. It's what we call a boondoggle. And I think it should be defeated and should be revised. As Adam admitted, the economy is doing well. It's growing out of this. The relief effort, thanks to Donald Trump's campaign to get a vaccine fastest in all of human history. Thanks to that, we are getting out of it, and we should see some positive results. We already are seeing them, and should continue to see them.
Thank you.
You know, from a Democratic standpoint, we talk about the Republicans living in a bubble. And here we are supposedly having the greatest, what they would say, the greatest medical system in the world. And our deaths are the highest. They don't look at the facts. Unemployment was not good yesterday when it was reported. They just don't want to look at the facts about things. Now, the biggest thing about the stimulus they don't like is goes to the poor, many of which are white, by the way, and that's a big problem with us. They're always against giving back to the people, and they don't pay them properly. And they justify it, for example, we have in front of us now a $15 an hour minimum wage, which would phase in. It's so low, it's ridiculous. And they say that companies will go out of business if they have to pay the people $15 an hour. But the other side of it is they like competition. If that guy goes under, can't pay those people properly, he should if he's inefficient. He should go under. There'll be someone else who will open up a more efficient business. So what they want is to have a low, to build the economy on the backs of, I would say, almost slave labor, where people, they just have no power here. Now, I don't come from that. I am a rich person. I did well in America. I'm a corporate, I had my own company. I'm not on lack of understanding of business. But I also saw my greed in my heart, which had bothered me. I was a union contractor, and I didn't like paying my men, who are plumbers and steam fitters, the high wage they received. I wanted it all for myself. I saw the greed in me, and I wasn't proud of it. But fortunately, because they were union, I had to pay their wages. And they were much, much higher than $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm. So I want to comment on the observation, which I think is correct, Peter, that the Democratic Party is more more divided than it appears. I disagree strongly that the media doesn't focus on it. I was listening this morning to three different channels, and they were all talking about it. But in any case, I think it's true. I think there is real division in the Democratic Party. And there always has been. I mean, it historically, it is a party that has, if you want to call it a big tent or a lot of division, any way you want to frame it, it's had a diversity of views. I think the danger for the Republican Party today is that it's moving only in one direction. And Trump is fueling that by deliberately saying, I will, anybody who's not with me, I'm going to endorse somebody to run against you who's to your right. And I think that's a real risk for the party going forward, because it will become a party, and is increasingly becoming a party, where there's only one voice. That's not a formula for success in a country as diverse as we are.
I agree with you, Adam.
Please, could you expand on how is the Republican Party? Is it divided, or is it kind of narrowing into the Trump bubble?
Well, I think it is divided. And I think Trump's leadership is a problem. We need new blood in the party. We need new leadership, and we need new opinions. Trump is showing his dictatorial side of him, which I think is unfortunate. So I think the divisions within the Republican Party are going to be problematic unless Trump is pushed aside eventually and by the members.
Do you think there is any chance for that?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, people don't like to lose. And, you know, there's 75 million people who voted for Trump who lost. And I think he was largely responsible for his own defeat, and doesn't want to admit that, of course. He wants to blame someone else. But I think the members of the Republican Party are looking for new leadership, and you know, they're going to be critical of anything they don't like that the Democrats do, and try to come up with enough votes to elect a Congress that is dominated by the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a quite new subject for us now, which is maybe not, it's related. And it is about Israel and United States. It has been remarked that President Biden has not taken any contact to Israel, which is a custom. It has been customary for the previous presidents. How do you see the government's attitude to Israel? How do you see the future, and how do you feel about it? Should we start, Alan?
Yes, well, the Israeli politics and situation in general is very close to my heart. I follow it much as I can. Again, the accomplishments of Trump, if you want to label it that way, in the Middle East, I mean, he just pretty much transformed the whole situation there. We'll have to wait and see. But the scenario is now different. I mean, it's one thing to make peace with your enemies, and it's another when the enemies act like the cousins that they are. That's a different set of conditions.
Could you explain what you mean by act as cousins that they are?
Right. I mean, the Abraham Accords are extremely significant in that the Arab countries, some of them anyway, are acting like they're accepting Israel as part of the overall geography of politics.
Okay, you mean the country that have
the countries
have made
that
agreement.
Signed up to the Abraham Accords.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And that type of starting point is different from just having two existential enemies, Palestinians and Israelis, try to reach some accord. It can never be any more than a cold peace that way.
Mm-hmm.
This transformation is historic. Will it last? I don't know. But again, it's subordinate to the schism between the Shia and Sunni Muslim communities. That has a lot to do with the success of the, so far, of the Abraham Accords.
Thank you.
But if that mindset prevails on the Arab side, it's transformational, no question. And I hope the new administration, whoever they are, and I wish them, you know, good luck. I'm not waiting for the Democrats to trip and fail. If they embrace that, that will be good news for Israel and I believe United States.
Thank you. Peter, how do you see that from your angle?
Well, I agree with Alan that the Abraham Accords are a wonderful result of negotiations that the Trump administration led and offer tremendous benefit to the whole region. I'm a little worried, not more than a little worried, that the Biden administration will abandon those policies. For example, just before the inauguration, the Trump people and Israel were negotiating with Indonesia, one of the largest Muslim countries in the world, and close to an agreement. Since Biden took over, he's backed off that. He backed off an agreement that Trump made with United Arab Emirates for a sale of F-35s, which you know was part of that negotiation. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm concerned about the Biden administration's refunding of the Human Rights Council, whose members are gross violators of human rights, and refunding of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. You know, he's funding that organization, which is not really a refugee organization. It's a false organization that's whole purpose of existence is to support the Palestinians' war against Israel. So I'm very concerned about the Biden administration 30 days or 60 days into its presidency with regard to Israel and the Middle East.
Adam, please.
Sure. Again, in the way of background, so for years I was the diplomatic correspondent for the Boston Globe. So the state under most of the time it was Jim Baker was the Secretary of State. So I saw this pretty close up. And by the way, with huge respect for Baker, for what that's worth. At the time, I believe Biden was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So his background in foreign affairs is deep and wide. I mean, that's for sure. Agree or disagree with policy. The answer to your question directly is I don't know. And I think I agree with everybody about the Abraham Accords. I think we have some unprecedented opportunities. I think there a lot of damage on the other side of the ledger, a lot of damage in terms of trust was undermined, and that has to be restored because negotiations require trust. That's the way it works. And I think Biden will work on that piece of it, certainly more than we've seen in the last 4 years. Whether that's a successful strategy, what his endpoints are, I don't know. I do, and I'm not saying that I will agree with them at all. I have disagreed with him on a number of foreign policy actions or views over time. But I think it will be very thoughtful. I think it will be deliberate. And I will watch the process unfold and hope for that it goes in a direction that we all can agree on. I think that the Middle East is a place where we should be able to come together in our objectives and the way we achieve them.
Thank you. Anything to add, Steve?
Very little. Basically where they are. I must say that Mr. Biden has a cabinet that's almost all Jewish.
Yeah.
Which might indicate something. And
does it?
And listening, the Republicans always come from, if it's a Democrat, it's not going to work with Israel. That's their their song. They have a lot of songs, that's one. And Israel has done fairly well since 1948 with under all administrations. So I'm optimistic, and I continue to be for the future. I think what where it is now is amazingly wonderful to have relationships with these Arab countries. Which there was a video that was so interesting that I forget which country it was, but they immediately had, when you walked into the food store, this big display of Israeli fruits and vegetables in this Arab country right after they signed an agreement. So I don't think the hate that was there had a real basis. It has nothing to do with the Egyptians, and you've seen that and so on. So I think they're going to drop that whole thing.
Thank you. Alexander, you have a question.
Yes, thank you. Well, my question goes on going back to Biden administration again, because Biden has employed a lot of people from his old Obama administration. And as we know, Obama administration was quite hostile to Israel. On the other hand, as one of you mentioned, there are very many Jews. I mean, there are about 10 or 12 Jews covering top positions in Biden administration. How do you think this can develop? And what kind of Jews are they? What are their views on Israel, and what are their attitudes?
You know, I'll take a shot at that, if
Thank
I
you.
May.
You're welcome.
The religion of a cabinet minister is entirely irrelevant. You know, especially Jewish people who make go over backwards, bend over backwards to avoid being perceived as advocating based on the Jewish religion. So I think that's irrelevant. I think the problem is that Biden is going back to the Obama administration. He's talking about he wanted to restart the program with Iran that was supposedly going to allow them to have nuclear weapons in 10 years that Trump shut down. I think that's very dangerous. I think we'll have to watch very carefully, because I don't trust the Biden people on Israel and the Middle East or foreign policy in general.
Do you find?
Yes? I just want to say, I bet if there were a Muslim in his cabinet, no one would be saying religion is irrelevant. It won't affect anything. I think it affects everything. I think I have a friend who says, what you see depends on where you stand. And I think that people's upbringing, people's backgrounds, of course, influence how they see things, I don't know what that will yield. I don't know. I don't think any of us can know. And the comparisons to the Obama administration may or may not be relevant. I mean, on some things, Biden is quite distinctly wants to depart from those policies, and some he will not. I think we have to see what and judge what occurs rather than what we fear.
Some of my American friends who are not present in Hope, they live in California, in Santa Cruz, and they claim that this very leftist democratic voters from California are anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic. Do you find that there is it is a case, and do you find that there is anti-Semitism in Democratic Party? Steve?
I think there's anti-Semitism in the United States. Democrat, Republican, Independents. There's racism in the United States across all of those lines. I think that California is a Democratic voting state, but boy, does it have some right-wing Republican areas, and that's fine. I mean, that's the reality of a piece of territory that's as big as most countries. But I really don't find, and again, I was up close to this for many, many years, for decades. Maybe it's changed. I haven't been a journalist for a while. But I certainly did not see that, and to the extent that I saw anti-Semitism, it was more, forgive me the stereotyping, but when I was covering Congress, for example, the institutional racism and anti-Semitism I saw was primarily in the West and Southern states, most of which voted Republican. Mm-hmm.
Steve, any comments?
I'm cloistered. I live in New York, Washington and all, where there are many Jews, okay, very successful Jews. They're in the country. In New York was finance, maybe. Here it's politics. I never hear any anti-Semitic statements. I'm not saying they're not there, but I never experience it. And in some ways it may be overblown from a Jewish standpoint. It isn't, but maybe it is. If one person out of 10,000 decides to shoot a Jew, it doesn't mean that everyone's anti-Semitic. And so if you bring rise to the few occurrences, and I hate the fact that Jews have been attacked, and make it universal, I don't think it's as strong as one might believe. I was just reading this morning, we have a ex-basketball star named Charles Barkley, very outspoken. He's a black man, married a white woman, both Christians. I was reading about his daughter's marrying a Jewish man. And this is what I see as basically in America, that there's a lot of interrelationships of all types, and Jews are fine. But that doesn't mean we don't have to be diligent. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other comments on anti-Semitism, Alan?
Yeah, I was going to just add a comment that comes from the emotional side of me. So it's not I don't want to paint this question of anti-Semitism with too broad a brush here. It really disturbs me to hear anti-Israeli venomous remarks coming out of Congress. We have some Congress people in, so happens, Democratic Party nowadays, who are spewing venom. Constructive criticism is one thing, but venom is something else. Poison is something else. And those voices are coming out of Congress.
But they are mostly Muslim.
Okay. Peter, any comments?
Plus Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is not Muslim. Plus Bernie Sanders, who is not Muslim.
He's a Yid.
Yes, he is. I know.
But Karl Marx was too.
He is very strongly anti-Israeli, at least, so to say.
I think there's a distinction that's lost here. I'm not denying that some of it is anti-Semitism for a moment, not for a second. But the lines have become really, really blurred between criticizing Netanyahu's government. Which is, again, people are entitled to vote for who they want, but we need to acknowledge the truth that's in front of us. He has a pretty distinct point of view, and he has implemented it successfully for the large part. You can be very critical of that if you don't believe that those are the right policies. And it does not necessarily make you anti-Semitic. I'm not saying that some of the stuff that's being said, to Alan's point, it doesn't cross that line. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the whole discourse relating to Israel often degenerates into, if you oppose Netanyahu's policies, then you are an anti-Semite. And I think that we fall into that trap a lot. A lot of people on all sides fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. And I think it is one. I think you could be very critical of Donald Trump's government or Obama's and not be anti-US. You can think that the policies, practices, whatever, of that particular leadership are wrong, or you just disagree, or they're anathema to you. You can feel very, very strongly. It does not make you anti that country or anti that religion necessarily.
Yes, but if I may remark about criticism of Netanyahu, because some of the criticism points on Netanyahu's policies concern the settlement policies. And these policies are pertaining to the very existence of the State of Israel and of the rights, whether they have the settlements, whether they are legal, illegal, and things like this. And this, in turn, provides the reaction of people are rather very anti-Semitic, claiming that Israel is acting like Hitler during the war, and adjectives of the rhetorics of the type. And I mean, there is one clear line which was put by the new rules of what is anti-Semitism and what is not. That when you criticize Israel for things that you do not criticize other countries for, this is anti-Semitism, and that's just plain like this. And unfortunately, the Netanyahu's policies that are very strongly, so to say, pro-Israeli. I mean, it would be strange that they would be otherwise. That this criticism is very often on the edge of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. At least this is the way that I see it.
Okay. And I
would like to put aside that we're all Jews. I want to know, picture the world without Israel. How would that affect the United States? If Israel vanished, 6 million people are gone and it's all Arab. And I would say that from a country's point of view, it doesn't matter that much. I think that our personal point of view, and I don't want to, you know, misinterpret where I stand, but I want you to take a view of anyone in another country looking at this. And I'm sorry, I'm near a window and there's someone. I think that it's overblown, the need for Israel for America. So when people come back and don't take the Jewish point of view, and look at it from an American point of view and what's best for our country, you get a different conversation. Now, I'm glad where we're at, but again, it's only 6 million people in a huge world that we have to deal with. And so I'd like you to just sit back and think about that for a moment, how others might see the need for Israel's existence.
But isn't it the only democratic point? Isn't it the only democratic? Sorry.
Why? What does it matter? Why
it does matter because it's the base for the values of United States. United States does not share the values with the Palestinians and the Arab country Syria and ISIS.
I agree, but it wasn't there in the first place. I don't see what matters. Those few people.
Oh well, I think that politically and strategically,
that's very great. It's great to have such a thing. They may have it in Costa Rica too, but it doesn't affect us. That Costa Rica was considered the third most democratic country in the Western Hemisphere.
I really strongly disagree with you, Robert. I think you deal with the reality that you have in front of you, and we do have a democratic state in the Middle East. The question is not what would happen if it disappeared. The question is indeed, what are the values we want to promote? And so ergo, we want to promote values in Israel and in other countries that we believe are the right ones, and those vacillate according to who's in power. The values that Donald Trump promoted are different than the values that Barack Obama promoted. There's no question about that. The values that Netanyahu promotes are different than what the old Labor Party used to promote. And, you know, my mother-in-law was Israel right or wrong. And if there was the left, they were correct and their policies were directly contradictory to the right. But when the right was in, they were correct. Well, but the point is that values do matter. We can all agree on that. It's not on just policy. It is tonal, it is demeanor, it is how you treat your friends and your enemies, and what are the objectives of U.S. foreign policy. If they are, you know, to make money, okay, that's one potential objective. If they are to spread democracy and voting rights and women's rights and minority rights, that's another thing. I think they should be the latter. We have been a very imperfect beacon of hope. But we have been that. And I think that that's the, so I think promoting that, those values and that role for Israel, that's what we've got. That's the vehicle we've got if those are the things that are important to us.
Thank you. Peter, any comments?
I'm listening and enjoying it and don't have any comments to add at this point.
Thank you. Alexander.
Yes, I would like to answer Robert's assumption that that nobody needs Israel to exist. In principle, this is what you said. I would say that why did U.S. enter into the Second World War? Was it a fight for values? Was it a fight for geopolitical influences? What was it for? Why there were 300,000 Americans that died in Europe fighting Hitler?
Good question.
Steve, you have to unmute yourself. Steve.
I know. I didn't want people to hear background. I was born at that time, but I don't know why people went in. And the question I would ask today is, now that we're alive, what if it happened again that we had to go to war in Europe? Would we go? I mean, there was a lot of conversation in the United States that they wouldn't enter that war.
Yes,
we went into Vietnam, and
what were they fighting for?
I don't know what the point was.
They were fighting for the culture. They were fighting for nothing else. They were fighting for the values.
I understand, but we went into Vietnam the same way. It seems to be okay now. The whole thing is very confusing to me, and we have a bias one way or another. All of us have biases to justify what we do and how we think. I don't know if it's, and I'm not saying Israel doesn't contribute to the world. I'm not trying to get rid of Israel when I said that. I'm just asking you to step back and look and say if there was no Israel or there was no Laos or there was no Vietnam, does it matter?
Let me say it differently. If you look from a military strategic point of view, America has been attacked by Muslim extremists, which have grown in the roots of Islam and the feudal regimes in the Middle East. And Israel is the only democratic anchor, the only place where you can kind of build a bridge of trust, of logistics, of development, of communication, intelligence, and so on. So I think that it's necessary to have some presence in this geopolitical landscape. What do you think?
I don't understand, Steve. I don't understand your point of view. Israel's existence is necessary for the Jewish people, for the Jewish religion.
No problem with that. I don't disagree with that. I don't. By the way, I support a lot of things in Israel. I said money and so on. Don't misunderstand where I'm coming from. I'm just saying we were attacked maybe because we were friendly with Israel. The question I was asking was how is it worth all of what we put into Israel for what we get? Maybe it is. I don't know. I'm just saying, if I was a neutral person, not Jewish, knowing nothing, what would I choose for America? That's all I'm saying. I'm biased. I can't see anything else. I'm willing to put all kinds of tax money from the United States into Israel and support it. No doubt.
Patrick, you're just providing a perspective.
I'm just trying to challenge your mind to a different point and push you into a different location to have you take a look at why some people in America might not support Israel as much as you would like.
The reason is anti-Semitism. I mean, I don't think we can escape our past. I don't think we can escape our present. It's there. It's like institutional racism. There's institutional anti-Semitism and institutional anti-womanism. I mean, the world did not get shaped yesterday. It has been shaped over the decades and the eons, and those views, those biases still exist. Mitigated. We know that we've made progress. All of those things are true, but they still exist and they still play a role.
That's correct.
I'm just saying that if the argument was give them $100 billion and someone else says $75 billion or $60 billion, it doesn't mean there's not support. I'm just saying they might say it's too much.
So you'd have to look
from my point of view, it's not too much, but that's not what I'm just trying to give another point of view.
I understand. I understand that you want to put us in put it in perspective. So I think that's why I put this geopolitical military angle as a perspective why US needs to have some place they can trust, because they can make all kind of alliances with Saudi Arabia or Palestinians, but they will run from the word the next day. They will sign an agreement, and then they will sign an agreement with somebody else or decide for something else, while Israel is an ally because of the common values and, you know, share life vision. So this may explain some kind of necessity or need for each other.
If I may, even from the standpoint of quid pro quo, the Israeli contributions in science, medicine, make it worthwhile for any country to be.
Yes.
To be.
I don't disagree.
Collaborating with Israel.
Yes,
I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying, for example, we have problems with Turkey and we have bases there. How much of our problems have to do with our association with Israel? I'm just saying, as an American, when you look at all the whole thing, is it worthwhile? Maybe this vaccine that they came up with or this treatments is worth it. I'm not saying they don't contribute to the world much greater than they are. I know that. I'm proud of that.
But
US, United States is supporting some values, at least on the outside, what they are saying that in the foreign policies they are supporting countries that share their values, which is to say NATO and Europe. Israel is the same, is not part of NATO, but still is the same orbit of values and culture. And in principle, US is not supporting the countries that oppose those values.
But Turkey is also
Turkey,
member of NATO.
Turkey is, yes, by geopolitical coincidence, necessary member of NATO, but maybe not as much anymore.
Okay, but let's look at Turkey. I think that the reason why United States is negotiating relations and with Turkey is because of the geographical point to have an anchor in the Middle East. But this anchor is unstable. If they didn't have Israel, they would have nothing. At least in Israel, there's one stable point where they can land their planes if they get attacked, where they can gather information if they need it, where they can have a foot inside the geographical and area. So I think that this is maybe the only reason.
Can I switch a little bit and ask you a question as Europeans? How do you see us under the Trump administration's policies for the policies you say we want to spread around the world? Like, how do you see it when splitting up families and children are still not with their parents? We're putting your knee on a neck of someone and then say the, and so on. How does the world see the policies of the United States under the past administration?
I guess just as you see it yourself. I think that Europe, this is my opinion, Europe generally is more like a democratic part of United States than like Trumpist part, but
you can't blame the police officer, terrible act on
exactly.
Donald Trump. He didn't.
No, but he didn't. The problem with Donald Trump is that not that he it was his knee. The problem with Donald Trump in the view of the press in Europe, as I read it, was that he didn't object it. He doesn't distance himself from the questionable personages. He doesn't. He didn't distance himself from the QAnon. He didn't distance himself from the racists. He said, "Oh, they're good people on both sides." But if somebody is a racist, we in Europe don't see this part as an equal.
The media distorted what he said and didn't give him up.
No, they did not. I can't listen to that. You show me your articles, I'll show you mine.
My question is, what are we spreading around the world with these values you're talking about, that you support Israel and certain values? What are these values we now have that we're spreading? That's the question.
I don't think that I see personally, I don't know about others, but I see personally Trump as a very weird growth on the earth of on the surface of Earth. He's sexist. He's rude. His language is primitive and he's hostile. I have heard things that were outrageous, and so for me it was like a crazy occurrence. It wasn't like my idea what United States is, not in person. And I think that a lot of his politics were good for Israel, and his divorce with China in economic terms was absolutely condoned by Europe. But just his personality, the way that he presented himself, the way that he was discussing with others, the way that he lied, and the way that he neglected the corona, you know, reducing it to a small flu. It was very corona. Much... Pardon?
Joanna, he didn't neglect corona. Anybody who was president at that time would have been overwhelmed by the information that they were getting, which was at first that this was nothing
he
to worry
about.
About.
He lied about it. He lied about it
continually.
He lied about it from the first day to the last. There are recordings of him with Bob Woodward saying different things than he said publicly. There was a big lie.
About the words that they want to, you know, attribute to him and ignore the ones.
The words that came out of his mouth.
Joanna, you are aware, Joanna, of the truth. That's the bubble you're listening to. They don't want to acknowledge what was going on.
By the way, regarding the policeman's knee on someone's neck, criticizing and viewing the police misbehavior is one thing. Pinning it on a Republican Party in any way is at best hypocritical. Think of the Dixiecrat wing of the Democratic Party in the heyday of the damage that was done.
Absolutely. And
we
it
don't
should
disagree
be,
with
it
that.
Should be condemned just as it should be condemned today. There's no difference.
You know,
Alan,
I think
Alan, the issue is that the left has been arguing about the police approach since I'm a young man. And the Republicans have always argued against the approach. And so you have this continuous abuse of power. You're not willing to address the abuse of power. It may be only 5% of policemen, I don't know, but you just don't want to acknowledge the abuse of power. And a lot of those people who become policemen, and we all become in our vocations, what we choose is much about who we are. And who we are as policemen would be someone who wants power. And they may be white supremacists, and they would tend to go to be policemen. Where firemen want to help, they're very different. They want to help people. And so we end up, I'm an engineer because I like math. And so we end up in a place which is comfortable for us. And so those policemen do like power and overuse it. And you should be on our side.
Simplification, Steve. You know, you're comments are full with oversimplifications, and that's just one of them. That people who go into police like power, that they believe in the values of the society, and they want to help enforce them, and to protect people. You know, protection of the average citizen who doesn't have a gun, doesn't have a billy club. You know, that's another motive to become a policeman.
Forgive me, I'm going to interrupt because I need to leave, and I apologize. I have another appointment that I need to go to. But I just want to say that whether it's the knee on the throat or anything else, we live in a country where values are important, where what you say matters, where elections matter. We have seen that dramatically on all sides. And so the truth matters. And when we live in a toxic environment in which people don't know what the truth is, don't believe the truth, when there are alternate truths, when beliefs are confused with truth and facts, then it is a dangerous place. We want to live somewhere where if there's a bad act, whether it's a cop or a rioter or anybody else, you want to live in a place where the truth is told about that, there are repercussions for actions, and the and issues are framed as with not which side am I on in a partisan way at all, but do I want to further negotiation rather than violence? Do I want to say out loud, I don't care if that guy you put in the car gets his head bashed? Or if you say, let's talk to each other, let's solve this problem, we have a problem. That demeanor, that tone, and the truth really, really matters. And that got lost for a long time. Whatever happens in terms of policy, I hope we can get that back. Well, and thank you all very, very much.
Thank you. We'll be rounding up. And if you have any final comments, please, would you like to add something to at the end, Peter?
Sure. I agree with Adam and, you know, his sentiment very much. It's very, very well said. I just think that one of the problems what we have right now is that, in sports, teams agree on the rules of the game and how to play. And there's a referee or someone who enforces that. We don't have that in politics. We have elections, we have voting and so forth. I think that the divisions that we have right now include the rules of the game. The Democrats want to change the rules of the game in terms of legislation in Congress. They want to eliminate the filibuster. I think that's a mistake. I think it's damaging. And I hope that it doesn't go through. I hope we solve some of these problems and we keep the dialogue going. Thank you for allowing me to participate.
Thank you. Steve, any comments to round up the meeting from your part?
I, like Alan, he had a background in a communist society. I grew up in one where we were the heroes out of World War II. And I raised my hand on my heart for the flag and set up Pledge allegiance to my flag and was so proud of my country, and because I only saw good. And as I've grown, I start seeing the reality, the truth about our country in the area of Native Americans, in the area of Blacks, which I didn't understand as a young man. And I see that we're long from perfect. And it's that I would like to see changed as I've learned about the truth about America. It has good and it has bad and a place to improve.
Thank you. Alan, you're the last but not least. Would you round up?
Right. So I appreciate the time with you for the same reason as I opened. I just love the thought of speaking to people from Denmark. And I'd like to again place myself in the middle. Let's be fair and not hypocritical in our criticism of the other side. Thank you.
Thank you all for participating. It was a pleasure. And I think we have a very interesting program for our listeners. And goodbye till the next elections.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye. Nice seeing you, Joan.
Nice seeing you all. Thank you. Bye.
Compadres in the United States.
Good panel. A very good panel with a diverse point of view.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Zu mir ist gekommen eine Cousine. Schön wie gold ist sie gewesen, die Grüne. Ekelig wie rote Pomeranzen, fiese Lärmes beten sich zum Tanzen. Ekelig wie rote Pomeranzen, fiese gelernt aus Beethoven zum Tanzen. Herrlich wie Seidenweb gelobte, zähnelich wie perlich getobte, egelich wie Himmelblei im Frühling, liebelich wie karschelich Zwilling. Egelich wie Himmelblei im Frühling, liebelich wie karschelich Zwilling. Hey! Nicht gegangen ist sie noch gesprungen, nicht gerät hat sie noch gesungen. Lebendig und freilich jeder Miene, Otta sei gewesen, ist mein Cousine. Lebendig und freilich jeder Miene, Otta sei gewesen, ist mein Cousine. Gegen mein Cousine und ich frag es Masse bis Grine. Sift sie ab und klägen in der Mine. Brennen soll Columbus ist Medina. Sift sie ab und klägen in der Mine. Brennen soll Columbus ist Medina.
Det var så udsendelsen om USA efter valget, og vi takker Adam Portman, Peter Pollack, Steve Levy og Alan Pertman. Og i studiet var Abraham Copenhagen og Alexander Slav ved teknikken, og Jonas og jeg som jeres vært. Tak for i aften.